well-designed experiments can really get to this fundamental question of how do institutions work and basic theories of why institutions are so important for economic growth and development.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Last week, James Robinson shared the Nobel Prize for his pioneering work in what the press release says is for studies of how institutions are formed and affect prosperity. The research we're highlighting this week was directly inspired by James Robinson's work and also the work of his colleagues and co-Nobelists, Daron Acemoglu and Simon Johnson.
We now accept that institutions, the rules of the game, help to determine economic growth, but studying how they do this using the rigorous experimental techniques popularized by the credibility revolution, well, that's difficult. And a lot of historical research into the consequences of institutional change, they just don't meet this threshold. But this is changing. A new review highlights an exciting new wave of empirical research into the consequences of institutional change. So I'm talking to two of the authors. I'm with Mike Callan at the London School of Economics. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, Mike.
Oh, thanks, Tim.
And Jonathan Weigel is down the line from the Haas School at Berkeley. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you, Tim.
Why do social scientists study institutions, study it so much at the moment? Which sort of institutions are they studying?
Ultimately, the goal is just to understand better why some countries are rich and others are poor. Economists used to study what we call now the proximate determinants of economic growth. And these are things like how many machines does a country have? How many factories? How much human capital? So things like physical and human capital. But then I think economists realized that they didn't really understand why some countries had simply more factories and other countries had less. Why some countries had higher levels of education, others had lower levels of education. So there was a shift toward the deeper determinants of growth. And these are things like geography, culture, and institutions. In the early 2000s and also continuing, there's a large empirical literature that increasingly finds institutions as really a crucial part of this story, probably the crucial part of this story. As far as what they are, I think it's important to say what they're not, perhaps first. They're not organizations. You know, so often today we refer to healthcare institutions, educational institutions. That's not what economists mean when we talk about institutions. What we mean are the fundamental rules of the game. That's Douglas North's famous definition. Humans create certain incentive structures that really govern our behavior, that shape our incentives. And that's what we mean by institutions. To give a few examples, is there the rule of the strong or is there the rule of law? What kind of labor markets do you have? Do you have competitive labor markets or do you have monopsonistic labor markets? What we focus on here is political institutions, so the political regime. How is the allocation of political power done in a given country? Is it through the electoral system, in which case you have a democratic regime? Or is it through some other mechanism of allocating power? The reason this is so powerful and why we study these institutions is that when you have a democracy in place, someone who wants power will focus their energies on getting votes and getting buy-in from a major political party. So that's what I mean when I say they shape our incentives. But if you're in China, that's not how political power is allocated. You're not going to have incentives to go out and muster votes from average individuals. You're going to be much more focused on coalition building and finding the right faction within the CCP, the Communist Party, Chinese Communist Party. So which rules of the game exist in a given country crucially shape the behavior of individuals and their incentives. That's why we really think they're a first-order determinant of really all outcomes that economists tend to care about. They're very sticky. And democracy, it's very hard for an office seeker to try to challenge that status quo, that equilibrium that we're all in and coordinating on, and seek power in a different way. This means that once you have a certain set of rules of the game, you often keep it. And we tend to think that whether you're on a path towards prosperity or whether you're on a path towards poverty, how do you get on one path versus another? And that's really the question we're interested in with this article.
And to research questions like this in the past, what techniques have economists used? And of course, other social sciences as well. It's not just economists that are interested in institutions at all.
Research on this question certainly has a really long history, arguably goes back to sort of the advent of economics as a social science. Mm-hmm. Because it's so fundamental, the thinking about why some countries are rich and others are poor, and it really is about what are the humanly devised rules of the game that govern human behavior. So it goes back to really thinking about it sort of philosophically, theory in the sense of long written treatises on how is it that humans interact. The next real stage was to try to at least formalize why is it that some countries are rich and others are poor, thinking about countries as the relevant unit of analysis, thinking about countries as having a production function where you put in capital and labor, and then you have efficiency in mixing capital and labor. That would be your normal residual that tells you why some are rich and others are poor. And embodied in that was often this notion that that would be institutions. So I think it's modern thinking about the role of institutions started with these formal models. The next big innovation was to actually bring this to the data. So to try to say, okay, how much of differences in income across countries or differences in income per capita is accounted for by capital and labor, and how much is in this residual, and can we pick up this residual with other things? Institutions are a challenging thing to think about. What's a normatively good institution? What is a normatively bad institution? But the innovation was to actually take measures of the quality of institutions and plug them into these comparisons to try to see how much they explained. And indeed, they were consistently relevant. The next step, though, was to wonder about, is this indeed a causal factor? Is it causally changing levels of income across countries? And a paper that I think was seminal in this was this Acemoglu-Johnson-Robinson paper that used settler mortality to instrument for whether or not institutions were good or bad. And this really was sort of the first to start making clear causal arguments that institutions causally determine levels of income, and also start to point toward what are the mechanisms that are translating different institutional arrangements into different levels of income. I think a parallel set of developments that was happening around the same time, so I think the paper was 2001, whereas, of course, the rise of randomized control trials and a focus on causal identification. And so many people probably see this as a natural coevolution where you wanted to just take this new, very powerful tool where you can test the causal relationship that you're most interested in, collect data on the question that you want to address, and turn that instrument towards working on what we think of as being the fundamental determinant of why some countries are rich and others are poor. So it's to basically take the tools of randomized control trials and use them to understand questions of governance, questions of institutions. So that's the progression as I see it in economics. Certainly, there's been lots of parallel investigations in social science as well.
Your paper is called Experiments About Institutions. So to be an experiment about institutions in the definition that you're using here, what principles does the research have to satisfy?
Well, the main thing, I guess, is it has to focus on variation in these fundamental rules of the game. So it has to actually ask a question about institutions in the way that we're thinking about them. Mm-hmm. There have been many experiments in economics that focus on policies. So some of the earlier experiments were in development economics, looking at what happens if you bring textbooks or some kind of medical technology and you have a treatment in a control group and you look at the outcomes and you have this powerful tool to assess the causal effects. It wasn't until around 2010 that researchers started thinking, well, can we try to adapt this methodology of the randomized controlled trial, the experiment, to fundamental institutional questions, to trying to study variation in those rules of the game? And this is hard to do, and it often means working closely with governments or political parties or civil society actors and trying to embed in what those groups are already doing some kind of random variation that lets the researcher and the collaborating partner jointly understand better the implications of trying to vary those rules of the game.
I should give Jonathan credit for the name. It's a title that I really like. And the reason that I like the title is because we've been experimentalists for most of our career. And there's a view that experiments really can't necessarily get at the big questions. Like, what is it about institutions that make some countries rich and other countries poor? What we're trying to do is provide lots of examples that can test that notion that experiments are really only useful for answering narrow questions, or experiments are really only useful for looking at one-off single policies. The argument that we're trying to make is that these are examples of cases where well-designed experiments can really get to this fundamental question of how do institutions work and basic theories of why institutions are so important for economic growth and development.
But when you look at the existing literature, how much of it satisfies your criteria for being an experiment about institutions?
Not that much. I mean, this is admittedly a small and growing literature. We're focusing a lot on the trend, which is upward. So we collected some data on this in the following way. This is imperfect, but hopefully gives us some way to answer your question. We looked at the top 13 economics and political science journals to try to identify those studies that both use field experiments and study these questions about the fundamental rules of the game. Mm-hmm. So in 2010, there was almost nothing on this. There were like two articles that met this overlap. By 2015, you had about 8% of total RCTs, 8% of total field experiments that were focused on questions of institutions, and about 5% of papers about institutions overall, there's more of those, use this methodology. In 2022, we're getting pretty close to 15% of total RCT papers and 10% of papers about institutions. This is just a first pass. We're surely leaving a lot of really important work out, but it's a pretty steep upward trajectory.
You make the point that it's very important to define what you call a critical juncture in real time in the story of institutional change. Why do that? It seems much easier to look back and identify it afterwards.
I think John and Noam and I started working on this review paper and a broader agenda around this collaboratively because all three of us actually have had the experience of running experience in the midst of critical junctures. And so for myself, I worked in Afghanistan from 2009 up until the Taliban took over. The whole time there was this ever-present feeling that these institutions really could go one way or the other. Now it's pretty clear which way they've gone. And, you know, the same was true for John working in Congo. The same was true for Noam working in Hong Kong during the protests 2016, 2017. So in all three cases, we realized and mutually acknowledged in the work that one another were doing that there's something going on here. We're kind of in these contexts, running experiments and learning about key institutions when we're really not sure what they're going to become or where they're going to head. And so we were trying to think, is this something that we could really operationalize as like a meaningful, testable, empirical concept? And so, you know, the argument that we're making about how you might have an empirically actionable definition for identifying critical junctures is focus on beliefs. So focus on beliefs about what are these institutions going to look like in 1 year's time or in 5 years time. The example that we use in the paper is we look at data from Afghanistan where we're looking to see whether or not people think the Taliban were going to win the war, or was the Afghan National Army going to win the war? And then try to see if this predicts whether or not people engage with the state in an important way, which is sort of take their legal disputes to the formal legal authorities. And we find that for people to be willing to do that, there needed to be both a consensus that the Afghan army would win and a high level of confidence that this was going to happen. And we've looked at this now in a few other contexts, and we're finding a pretty consistent pattern.
The idea of a critical juncture is there's really fundamental uncertainty, and it could go either way, which institutions could shift or they could remain on the current course. And we think that academics tend to have this bias towards the moments when they did change, because those are the ones where you observe an autocracy collapsing and a democracy arising, and it's a really momentous thing. Whereas there can be moments of deep upheaval and potential change that don't actually lead to that, but are just as important. So if we want to study critical junctures, we need to have the negative cases, the cases when nothing changed. It's a classic example of selection bias. You're not going to be able to possibly understand what leads a critical juncture to actually change institutions if you only look at the ones where those institutions did change. Focus on the possibility of change. That's really what defines a critical juncture. And this is where we think the role of beliefs is really crucial. If you're studying these things in real time, you can actually go out and survey elites, citizens, you know, any kind of stakeholder, and ask them, well, what do you think will determine the way political power is allocated in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years? And our idea is that disagreement over that question is indicative of the kind of fundamental uncertainty that we expect in a critical juncture. If a large share of citizens in Afghanistan believe that the electoral mechanism will choose who rules the country in the next 10 years, that's evidence that democracy is getting consolidated. Everyone is coordinating on elections as the way to allocate power. But if many people think that the Taliban is just going to simply take over and no one's going to pay attention to elections, then that's evidence of a different potential institutional path. So when you observe some people believing it will be the Taliban who decides how power is allocated, and many other people thinking it's democracy, that variance, that diffusion in beliefs at a moment in time suggests that that moment contains these multiple possibilities, that different institutional paths are possible. And that's how we think, in fact, you could empirically study this in real time. You can go out and collect these data about beliefs about future institutions. And we're hoping to be able to do this more broadly in the future.
But how do you measure beliefs?
This is, I think, one place that economists do devote quite a bit of attention. We have beliefs about contemporary matters, beliefs about future matters. And so because they're so central in our models, they're central in any economic model where you're thinking about coordination around an equilibrium, there has been just a lot of investment in thinking about protocols for how to elicit and measure beliefs.
Can you give an example of a moment, a critical juncture, which did not lead to institutional change?
Yeah, so there's many, some are famous and some have been forgotten about. And this is part of the reason we think it's important to study them in real time, because you might not forget about the ones where change did not occur. So some of the famous ones that people will remember, the 1848 revolutions in Europe, you had Marx expecting massive social change. And in just about every case, there was moments of intense uncertainty, people taking to the streets, and things basically kept the course they were on. Another famous example is Tiananmen Square, students taking protesting the regime, a potential moment in which there was really deep uncertainty about what the future of China looked like. Would there be more and more openness, this push for democracy? Would those calls be heard and answered? Or would the students be violently repressed, right? And that moment is one in which the regime made decisions that had really enduring consequences and sealed China on this institutional path of autocracy. Recently, I think there's quite a few that are top of mind now, which might not be top of mind in the future. So in 2023, there were massive anti-Netanyahu protests in Israel. And now this is almost overshadowed by the war in Gaza. But imagine if Netanyahu had not survived that huge popular uprising in the summer of 23. It could have enormous consequences on what we observe in the Middle East right now. And that was a moment in which it could have probably gone either way. I mean, I'm not a scholar of that region, but from what I understand is there was a real chance that he would have to step down. A different coalition would come in. That coalition would govern in a fundamentally different way. Another famous example from recent is the Prigozhin March on Moscow.
Yes.
And you had a real unexpected moment in which it looked like this stranglehold that Putin has over Russia might be challenged. And again, think about the implications that that might have had. But ultimately, Putin maintains his stranglehold on power and the war in Ukraine continues. These are all moments in which there really was a time in which there was fundamental uncertainty about which way it would go. It could have been almost like a coin flip. Which way it did land, that coin, shaped crucially the institutional path and the outcomes that ensued.
In these situations, whether or not institutional change happens, how can you define an experiment? You have to have a treatment and a control. What does an experiment mean?
An experiment in these contexts means the same thing, at least broadly, as it would in any context, that you want to have truly random variation in the causal explanatory variable that you care about. Mm-hmm. I think what's special here is that you're trying to take core notions about what makes institutions work and really establish core causal relationships. So John has done work in the Congo demonstrating that once you start to collect taxes for the first time people are being brought into the tax net, their engagement in civic institutions increases. And that's clear because it was causally set up to test that question.
Yes.
Now, if I were to look instead across countries and say, look, places where people pay more taxes are also places where people generally have higher levels of civic engagement. We observe that in data. That's not something that you would ever believe. And it's also not necessarily give a causal attribution, but the core idea of sort of how does the social contract form and how is it maintained? Well, there's this sort of co-relationship between citizens and the state where the citizens pay taxes and the state in turn supplies services. I mean, that is fundamentally a causal argument about what the social contract is doing. So I think that's what we mean when we say an experiment about an institution. It's core institutional theory about the rules of the game and testing the deep causal relationship at the heart of one of those theories.
In a lot of the work on institutions, there are a lot of outcomes over a very long period of time measured. When you're looking at this experimental context, what sort of outcomes can you measure?
Yeah, so I think this is one of the key advantages of an experiment, or at least of engaging deeply in primary data collection in real time, is that you can measure exactly the outcome that you're interested in or construct environment where you measure the outcome that you're interested in. These are often things like participating in politics or signaling engagement with the state, paying taxes, things that aren't necessarily going to be sitting around for you in existing archival administrative data sets, but that you would really need to understand if institutional theories are correct.
You did mention before, there is that feeling that RCTs cannot answer the big questions. These are very big questions that you're asking. Can these experiments about institutions address the big questions?
Yeah, so there's a very famous political economist whose name I will not mention, who once said, "You'll never be able to do an RCT about something I'm interested in," which I think captures exactly the idea that you're mentioning here, that
yes.
How could you possibly use an experimental methodology on questions that bear on the rules of the game? Doesn't it have to be focused on smaller policies? I think the answer is yes. We think there is increasing evidence that if you work at it, you can find ways of embedding randomized controlled trials during moments of fundamental institutional change to ask really big, important questions about those institutions. So let me give a little bit of, you know, a few examples to make this clear. I think one of the early questions that was tackled this way was by Ben Olken in Indonesia, where the question he wanted to study was whether direct democracy can outperform representative democracy. You're not going to be able to randomize countries into different types of democracy, of course, but what he did in the paper is to work with development projects in Indonesia and have different communities have different mechanisms of basically choosing the types of public goods that they wanted. And so sometimes they came and everyone directly chose, and other times they chose through representatives. And he was able, through that approach, to demonstrate that when there is direct democracy, citizens have much higher levels of satisfaction. Another example is Mike's work. The really fundamental question in new democracies is, how can you increase faith in elections? Mm-hmm. And so, as Mike mentioned, he's been working in Afghanistan for a long time. If you increase the perceived integrity, the actual and perceived integrity of elections in Afghanistan, well, how does that affect outcomes? How does that affect people's willingness to participate in democracy, to accept that we choose leaders that way, and to go along with all the other formal state institutions? By working with an election monitoring intervention, randomly assigning that all across the country, he was able to demonstrate that by randomly increasing the integrity of elections, you can really increase faith in democracy and the corresponding institutions of the formal Afghan state. You have studies looking at whether multi-member districts or single-member districts are preferable, whether you can offset the resource curse by providing information. And these are all questions that bear on really fundamental theories about the evolution of institutions and their role in economic growth.
Are you therefore claiming that this type of institutional economic research is better than the research we had before?
No, that's not necessarily what we're claiming. There are well-known limitations to experimental research. It's always going to be context-specific. There's always going to be questions about external validity. But I think just as with experiments in general, when you bring the tools of experimentation to questions about institutions and how institutions affects sort of the performance of the state and economic development, there are also natural advantages. I think first, you can introduce causal variation into the thing that you're interested in understanding or the object of theoretical relevance. You can measure what you need to really test the idea at hand. I think the point is that we think we've found an ample number of examples to the point I wouldn't even think it's really a controversial or a particularly groundbreaking statement to say that you can use experiments to learn things about institutions. There are plenty of examples.
But it seems a pretty difficult thing to do. This is really impressive research. How can researchers who want to get involved in this, who haven't done this sort of research before, how can they get involved?
It can be demanding. I think none of us would deny that. Mm-hmm. It is also really an incredible experience as a researcher to get involved in this kind of work, because it means you are getting embedded or seconded into a government or a civil society group. I think all the examples we cite rely on deep collaboration with these partner organizations that are themselves key actors in the process of institutional change. So as a researcher, it's really thrilling to be in the throes of institutional change and witness it yourself. I mean, just sort of speaking from my own experience, I started working in Congo and learned that the government was trying to really expand its property tax net, and found myself before long going to the tax authority every day, trying to figure out what problem the tax authority staff were trying to solve, trying to think if there's anything I could do to help them solve that. That process of just being there every day in the tax authority taught me so much about what the real constraints are in this setting and how to build trust with that partner. I think that's a crucial answer to your question, is why would a political party in Sierra Leone ever be interested in randomizing how much openness and inclusivity there is in the way they choose their candidates? That seems like a real stretch. Well, the answer is that Casey and others have been working with them for a very long time and have built real trust that they can find common ground. Can't always find common ground. You know, it's worth pointing out that there's times that researchers want to study something and the partner is just absolutely not interested in that. But in that example from Sierra Leone, the parties were interested in how to find better candidates and whether there was a way to do something that looked like a primary a little bit that involved eliciting voter preferences and finding out who they actually like the best of these candidates that would then help in elections, right? And that turned out to also be a question of massive academic interest if you're interested in how democratic institutions function. Casey and her co-authors were able to do a randomized controlled trial where they did find, in fact, creating something that looks a bit like a primary improved how much the candidates in Sierra Leonean politics are representative of the average citizen in Sierra Leone. And those candidates were ones with a better track record of providing public goods. And so it was a clear sort of win-win between the interests of the party and the interests of the researcher. And our experiences, I think Mike would agree with this, is that there's often more common ground than you might initially think.
Every researcher wants to be policy relevant, but often that's quite frustrating. It sounds like this sort of research can influence policy, can it? What level can it do that?
In a lot of the examples that we review in the review article, we find examples that were sort of fairly substantial and meaningful policy impact. And I think that that's for good reason. I think first, so when you're focused on these core institutions, these are things that you imagine, if you understand them and if you can improve them, that there are potentially very substantial knock-on effects. So kind of coming back to the example of the election monitoring work in Afghanistan, the idea was, can we find a way to enable citizens to monitor their own elections? Mm-hmm. And this was meant, you know, by design to be sort of an innovation, sort of use mobile technology to make this easier. And that was scaled. So that was used subsequently in Afghanistan. It was used in Kenya. It was used in South Africa. I think in the Development Innovation Ventures, the funder did a review and it was something like 5.5 million people were impacted by that. And I think it's just because making elections cleaner and fairer is something that can lead to all sorts of positive downstream outcomes. It's very natural that sort of focusing on institutions and improving institutions can potentially have very substantial policy impact.
Yeah, it's a fascinating lens on institutional economics. Thanks very much for talking about it. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Tim.
And thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Tim.
I expect you want to read the paper now. So it's called Experiments About Institutions. And the authors are Mike and Jonathan, who you've heard from, and Noam Yuchtman. It is NBER Working Paper 31964. Also, we mentioned that research into how political candidates are selected. And we had a VoxDev talk about that earlier this year in March 2024. Look for the episode called Selecting Political Candidates in Sierra Leone. This has been a VoxDev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe. Go on, do it now. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org. And if you've enjoyed this today, I'm pretty sure you have, tell someone else about VoxDev and then they can hear conversations like this.